Welcome. My name is Gilad Bernstein, and thank you for joining us for another episode of the AI and Faith podcast. On this podcast, we bring together experts from our community and thought leaders from around the world so that together we can learn the key lessons required to build the world where AI benefits humanity and all of us individually.
Now we have different genetic modification technologies that can save people's lives from otherwise horrible deaths. And we're seeing more and more come along more and more quickly. So the question is always there. How far should we go? From a faith perspective, how far are we meant to go? How far are we meant to tap into whatever that human creativity is that I would say is part of being made in the image of God from my theological perspective? But other people aren't as sure about that. So it opens up a really thorny conversation.
As we all know, the great commoditization of AI is endlessly broad and touches every element of our world and lives. Today, I'm excited to go back to a topic we've covered a few times on the podcast and an area where AI's impact is going to be enormous. And that's the area of biology and how we should all be thinking about that and preparing for the changes that are here to come. And we have two outstanding guests that are going to help us think about this realm and think about the bioethics elements of that as well. So let's get started. Thank you both for joining us today. It is really wonderful to have you with us for this conversation. And to kick things off, I'm hoping you could tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about your areas of focus. And Tracy, please start us off.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. My name is Tracy Trothin. I am an academic at University in Canada, Queen's University, where I have a joint appointment in the School of Rehabilitation Therapy and the School of Religion. I am a full professor and an interdisciplinary ethicist. I started off as a theologian and eventually moved to embrace the healthcare aspect of my interests even more, and was fortunate enough to be able to have this joint appointment in which I could do that. I am also a trained and certified chaplain with CPE, and I'm a supervisor as well.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. And Jason?
I'm a rabbi. I serve as the senior rabbi and director of the spiritual care department at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. I'm also rabbi of a synagogue in Los Angeles. And my real area of interest is in bioethics as well as chaplaincy. And I'm also a board certified chaplain, but I have a doctorate in clinical bioethics, and I've published a number of books on, you know, Jewish bioethics. And so I'm really interested in, you know, trying to figure out how to do the right thing in a complicated world.
Absolutely. And before we jump into biology and bioethics and this entire ecosystem, we want to spend a few minutes learning a little bit about the role of a chaplain. So maybe Jason, you can kick us off this time and tell us a little bit about what does a chaplain actually do and what are you trying to accomplish within that role?
Yeah, so there's multiple areas where a chaplain is trying to be supportive. I'm speaking now about healthcare chaplaincy within a hospital, you know.
Yeah.
There are times when a chaplain is specifically performing specific rituals and religious observances to help people, you know, sort of transcend the walls of the hospital and be connected to their faith community. But more generally, chaplains are about spirituality and helping to care for the whole person. So when we care for a patient in the hospital, we don't want it to be just like a bar in a garage where it's just like caring for the body and just fixing the physical ailments. But we recognize that people are more than their physical aspects. There is emotional and relational and spiritual aspects of who we are. And chaplains are the ones who are dedicated to trying to help people find spiritual connection in the hospital or in times of illness, and recognizing that sometimes even when a cure is not possible, there's still sometimes sorts of healing that can be possible, spiritual, relational healing.
I love that. I love that. And Tracy, how do you think about that role?
I agree completely. Being a chaplain or a spiritual care provider, as we tend to refer to chaplains in Canada, is about holding the person that you're walking with. It's about hearing them more deeply into their struggles, their questions, not judging, listening for spiritual needs, listening for unmet spiritual needs especially. And when I say spiritual needs, I'm thinking of those needs to belong, to be loved, to find a sense of meaning and purpose, and to love others and seek reconciliation. I mean, these are big, big things that really go to the heart of what it means to be human.
Yeah, absolutely. And what got you into this world, Tracy? Like, you originally did not come into the world to be a chaplain. So what opened your eyes? Like, how did you get into this field of work?
Well, it's interesting. I decided when I was doing my undergrad way back when in history and psychology that I really kept going back to my faith community, my questions about the meaning of life, my questions about the transcendent. What is more than, what do we mean by purpose? What does it mean to feel called or drawn to a particular vocation? And how do we know what it is, where it is that we're meant to be? And so I ended up studying my Master's of Divinity at Queen's University and then got more and more intrigued in ethics and questions of social justice. So I decided to pursue a doctorate in that. But while I was doing my doctorate, I did some more training in spiritual care and chaplaincy at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto. And while I was there, the experiences that I had walking alongside families of children in the hospital affected me profoundly. And that continues to hold a very special place in my spirit and my heart. And I am always looking for ways to honor those stories and to create hospitable space for relationship and wholeness.
Yeah, absolutely. That's beautiful and something that really resonates with me as well. Now, Jason, one more question to you about this kind of macro opening. It's, I imagine within the hospital, there are chaplains from different faiths and different backgrounds. And obviously the patients at the hospital come from all different faiths and different backgrounds. How do you balance like the inner faith element of overseeing chaplains from lots of different backgrounds?
One of the things I love about the hospital is that, you know, even at times when there are tensions and sadly disagreements in different faith traditions or, you know, things that come up maybe politically or whatever it is, in the hospital is a place where we're dedicated to compassion, to helping people who are in need, to being present for people, to being non-judgmental, as Tracy said. And it's just, I always find it so inspiring how there's a genuine sense of trying to find common ground and love and respect in a hospital. In some ways, it's like an ideal environment. You don't want people to be sick, but it's like in the hospital, there's just this unique sense of respect and camaraderie. So it already starts from a good place. And I find that when you're respectful to people, you know, it goes a long way. And in the hospital, one of the things we recognize is that, you know, all people are in some ways like everyone else, in some ways like some other people, and in some ways like nobody else.
Yeah.
What we try to do is, let's say I'm a chaplain for a patient that's not my religion, but you know what? They're going to be like me in some ways, meaning they're going to be like me in that they feel isolation. They don't want to feel pain. They don't want to suffer. They want to feel connection, community. You know, we can find, there are ways to find common ground in the midst of suffering that can help people regardless of any things that in other areas of life might divide us and separate us. In the hospital, we're able to find the ways that we can actually find healing in our areas of connection.
I love that. And clearly we need more of that in our world. Now, I want to move directly into the field of bioethics. I want to start with kind of the million view question. And Jason, I'll put you in the hot seat. What is bioethics? What does that field entail? And then, of course, how do you think about it as a rabbi?
It's a great question. It's a challenging question because sometimes people ask me, you know, since I got my doctorate in bioethics, every now and then, like a challenging moral or philosophical question will come up and someone will say, okay, Jason, you're the bioethicist. What's the right thing to do? What's ethical? Yeah. What's not ethical? It's not so simple. I mean, in a hospital environment, as we're transitioning the conversation, just like chaplains, our job is to kind of be, I love this phrase. I once heard it. I don't remember where, I just remember hearing that, you know, chaplains are like architects of spiritual space. We create areas for spiritual reflection in the midst of the scientific fast-paced hospital. So ethicists are trying to create space, architects of moral reflection, that sometimes things happen and we need someone to stop and say, wait, is this the right thing to do? Have we thought about this? Is this just? Is this equitable? Is this appropriate? Now, different ethicists might have different models that they use for determining what's, you know, right and wrong. And in fact, most people, especially in the diverse, multicultural, modern societies we live in, usually have ethicists in the hospital. Their job is not to come in and tell everyone, this is right, this is wrong, you're right, you're wrong, you're bad, you're good. You know, it's actually we need to have a space to have the conversation, to help flesh out what matters for them, what's meaningful to them. How can we work together? How can we focus on helping this person in the way that's most meaningful to them and within the bounds of sort of the law and the culture of medicine and work together? So it's a place for discussion and reflection about what's ethical, what's right, what's appropriate. That's the way I see it.
Yeah, absolutely. And what resonated most with me is that you put the patient at the center. It wasn't some sort of a logic or math equation that we were working through to find the right answer. It was really about the human that's at the middle of this whole thing. And I thought that was a really beautiful way to center it around the patient. And then Tracy, bringing you into this, what do you have to add? How do you think about bioethics in that field? And then also you teach bioethics and spirituality. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes, I agree with everything that Jason said. He put it beautifully. Talking about the person instead of just focusing on bioethical principles, which is the history of bioethics in the last century, where we tended to focus on just four traditional principles of doing good, avoiding harm, respecting autonomy, and justice. I think it's much more complicated than that, much more fluid, much more narrative oriented. So I'm very interested in a virtue ethics kind of approach that looks at the character that we each are, what kind of character we hope to cultivate, asking questions like, if I behave in a certain way, how will that contribute to or take me away from the person I want to be? You know, so really boiling it down to, what do I value most about life? Yeah. What do I want to be known for? So if we think about it in terms of, you know, how do we want to be remembered when we die? What might our obituary, if we decide to have one, what might that say? That can help us really locate what those core values are that are most important to us and can serve as guideposts, I think, to our behavior and the way we act with each other and the earth every day. When I teach the bioethics course, it's a bioethics and religious studies course to undergraduate students, I find that they get most intrigued, focused, stirred up, and they show up to class more often when it's centered around real stories of real people, anonymized, of course, but where I have guest speakers come in too and tell complicated stories. Say I have someone who works in emergency medicine in a hospital coming in to talk to them about what it's like to be an emergency room doc and what they struggle with most, and how that might connect with spiritual needs, that spiritual need to love others, to belong, to have a sense of meaning and purpose. What are their struggles too in the ER? What are the struggles of anyone? And how do we meet those struggles? Of course, it being a course about bioethics, we talk about things like medical assistance in dying, which is a tough topic, but I find that my young undergraduate students are more than ready and eager to dive in and ask questions about it. They finally have a space where it's not only okay, but they're being invited to think about this and say what they think out loud.
I love that. Absolutely. The good kind of safe space. And Jason, you both teach at university and I think at high school maybe as well, but you also interact with doctors every single day. So I'm curious, what are they asking you, both the doctors and the students, when they think about bioethics, what are they asking you about?
For me, there's a few things. In the hospital, you know, I'm primarily chaplain, right? And I'm not just chaplain, I'm rabbi in the hospital. So I'm from a particular tradition. So the questions that arise for me are usually like, here, we know what we would normally do. We know what we want to do. We know what we think is right. But does your tradition, does a patient from your community have certain idiosyncratic approaches that we should be aware of, you know, because that is part of the reality of the diverse world that we live in, that even if, and as you pointed out so well, like we are a patient-centered focus. And so like, even if we have notions of what we think is the right thing to do in certain cases, but people also, you know, come from different backgrounds and traditions and have, we also try to honor who they are, where they come from. So for me in the hospital, it's more, most often, how do we apply our commitments to being respectful to people from different backgrounds. In the high school, you know, I teach it both in high school classes of ethics, of Jewish bioethics, and also to graduate level courses. And what I have found people are most interested in lately, at least what I'm finding, is transformative technologies. the things that are coming down the pike, although, yes, like MAID, that's a big one. There's a lot of issues that come up in the hospital, but like things like CRISPR gene editing and longevity, sort of these anti-aging techniques and things like that, genomics, you know, lots of fascinating stuff that's really has the potential to kind of transform life as we know it. And people I'm finding are like fascinated, terrified, and want to talk about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this was like the perfect transition. I wish I could say I planned it exactly this way. But I would love for us to dig into a few of these and for you to bring your own ethical background and your own faith and religious background into the conversation. And how do you think about those things? So maybe we'll put Tracy in the hot seat first this time around. So how do you think from both an ethics and a religious perspective about things like gene editing and this pursuit of longer and longer lives?
Well, it's an excellent question, and it's a very loaded question. We tend to avoid or think that the pursuit of a longer life or a radically extended life is the wrong thing. It's a misplaced quest. But at the same time, if we look back historically, we have a stunning history of coming up with new medical therapies to extend life. We can look back to the 50s when we had our first heart surgeries. And initially, the regard for touching the heart was the heart is a sacred thing. It's not meant to be tampered with by humans, that it's taking us away from being made in the image of God. From a Christian perspective, for example, that somehow we're not meant to do this. We're verging on playing God. We're becoming too lofty. But at this point, we would, very few of us would say no to a needed heart surgery if it could mean extending our life, improving the quality of our life. And most of us know at least someone who has had heart surgery, and it's been life-saving, literally, and just phenomenal. I mean, little kids, babies who are blue babies that literally have blue skin because they have a hole in their heart can now go into the ER and with a very fairly short operation, usually the hole is closed, they come out and immediately they look pink and healthy despite having been cut open surgically. So it's just amazing. And then probably the next big hurdle was indeed the human genome and the fear that the genome is sacred and we're not meant to touch it. It is beyond what our place is as created humans from a religious perspective. But now we have different genetic modification technologies that can save people's lives from otherwise horrible deaths. And we're seeing more and more come along more and more quickly. So the question is always there. How far should we go? From a faith perspective, how far are we meant to go? How far are we meant to tap into whatever that human creativity is that I would say is part of being made in the image of God from my theological perspective. But other people aren't as sure about that. So it opens up a really thorny conversation about what it is we're meant to do from a religious perspective, from a faith perspective, and where those limits might be. For example, I can definitely see that there are religiously informed, really important, valid messages that say we should not be seeking to have designer babies, right? To go in to do gene editing because we like blue eyes better than brown. That's just scary. And extend that further to what sex we want in a baby. And in a culture where women aren't and girls aren't valued as much, this can be very, very dangerous. So what fetuses do we value? What do we not? How might these technologies facilitate or reinforce this kind of bias? And, you know, what lives do we value?
Absolutely. And I love, I mean, so much of what you said, but really one of the commonalities between these examples you gave is how these continuums don't have bright lines to tell us where to stop, right? So the example I always use with life extension, exactly like you said, you know, if I have an ailment that is extending my life. No one says I should not cure that illness or that disease I have, but I will probably live longer if I cure it than I don't. And like you said, there isn't a bright line between taking care of medical problems and optimizing for moving further. And the same example, our longtime audience will remember, we spoke a lot about designer babies or genetic engineering of babies last season or last year, and talked about the fact that there isn't a bright line there either. Like, if you're going to stop your kid from having some sort of terrible illness when they're born to protect their heart or brain or whatever, well, where's the difference? Or if someone is so short that it'd be really hard for them to carry things or to live throughout society, well, where is the line that you're going from, therapeutic enhancement of height to aesthetic? And I just think that's a really important point you made there, that unfortunately, it'd be easier if there was. There are no bright lines in the sand to tell us exactly where we're going from one to another. I think this is a really difficult concept. Now, Jason, bringing into this, I often use the Jewish concept of pikuach nefesh when talking about ethics. And pikuach nefesh simply means that we do almost anything to preserve and protect a person's life. And that, things like Shabbat or other things that we're commanded to follow simply go out the window if the opportunity is to save someone's life. So that one we've used a lot on the podcast. And what are there other Jewish principles that you think about in kind of making these decisions or recommendations for patients and others?
Yeah. So, and pikuach nefesh, yeah, that's an important principle. But another principle that we focus on a lot is kavod habriyot, which means human dignity. We really go out of our way to focus on human dignity. I mean, I'll give you an example. I was just in Ethiopia, visiting the Jewish community in Ethiopia. And, in Judaism, in Jewish law, we don't get tattoos. Tattoos is a prohibition. So I noticed there was a lot of people, a lot of women have tattoos on their faces in Ethiopia. It's very common there. And some of the women there asked me, they said, as they're getting involved with the Jewish community, some of them even have a cross on their head, on their forehead. They're Jewish. They have a cross. That's because it was done when they were children to protect them from the evil eye. Their mothers thought that they were very beautiful and wanted to protect them in that way. But now they felt that they don't want to have that cross anymore. So this is just here, just giving an example of how we analyze this question. So here's her question. She says, and I could see it. The cross is engraved into her forehead, into her skin. So she can't just get that removed. So she asks me, it's just this interesting rabbinic question. Can I have another tattoo to hide the current tattoo? So in other words, she wants to do something that's prohibited by Jewish law.
Yeah.
But in order to, she will feel better about herself. And I posed the question to a very senior, great rabbi. I said, are tattoos allowed? No. Can't you get a tattoo though for this reason? He said, yes, that's because for the principle of kavod habriyot, just like pikuach nefesh overrides almost everything else, so to the principle of human dignity, doing whatever we can to protect and promote an individual's human dignity also overrides prohibitions.
I love that. What a perfect example of that. Thank you for sharing that. Now, I do, of course, want to bring artificial intelligence into the conversation. And I want to start by just setting the stage for those of us further away from hospitals or medical clinics or elsewhere. And maybe we'll start with Jason and go to Tracy. Give us some examples. Where's AI and other kind of modern technologies being integrated into medical care, into hospitals? And what are a few of the big questions we should be asking as we integrate these things?
Well, it's being integrated quite a lot. I mean, I'll just give a couple of examples, but like that, I could just, and I'm sure Tracy could too, I'm not saying about myself, but I could just spend the next hour just rattling off. But just a couple of prominent areas. One is ambient AI documentation. It's fascinating. It's fascinating also because I just had an encounter where, so what that is that there's AI listening in the background when, when physicians or healthcare providers in general, meet with their patients and then it can do the charting for them. And it creates a chart note, which is very time consuming for a healthcare provider. And, I remember I'm actually old enough. You might think I'm young, but I've been working in this hospital long enough. I remember when doctors charted by hand, when they wrote in the physical note, and that no one could read a word they said. Now, AI, it's great. Not only do they not have to spend a second doing it, it's perfectly legible, perfect grammar, no typos, perfect bold and bullet points. Not only that, the ambient AI can actually diagnose. Just from listening to not only the conversation, but even from the voice, you can diagnose cardiovascular disease just from the patient's voice. It does bring up a lot of issues. I mean, as an interesting side point, some observant Jewish physicians already asked me, what do I do on Shabbat? On Shabbat, we don't use electricity, but I'm just talking to the person and it's causing electricity to be, implemented. Also, a physician just told me that, a patient just told me, we have open notes now. Patients can see their notes. Patient told me that he was talking to his doctor. And his doctor was just showing empathy and having a conversation. And while they were talking, the doctor mentioned one of his own illnesses, and it got into the patient's chart as if it was the patient's, because the AI didn't understand the doctor was talking about himself. And now that person has in his chart an illness that is not he doesn't have. Anyways, that's one. There's also serious illness finder scores, you know, where patients are kind of, there's AIs going into the charts. First of all, sometimes finding illnesses that otherwise wouldn't have been caught, but yeah. Also trying to rank patients and kind of determine who is you should utilize the ICU, who should be triaged quicker in the emergency room, you know, and also sometimes notifying chaplains, hey, this person's expected to deteriorate, which it does bring out a lot of, it can be very, very helpful, you know, because you can catch things that you wouldn't have otherwise caught. Of course, it can cause so many problems, you know, equity concerns. And, you know, there's self-fulfilling prophecy. Sometimes the AI predicts something, which doesn't have to happen, but once it starts predicting it, kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy at some times, or people end up treating the patient. There's something known as automation bias, where people unfortunately tend to believe, you know, AI and computers and assume it's right when oftentimes it is right. It is, but sometimes it's totally ridiculous. So that's a challenge. And one last I'll mention just for the sake of time is an interesting one that is being proposed, you know, it's starting to be rolled out, but it's still new, where patients, at least in my hospital, I know elsewhere might be, patients are being helped to fill out their advanced care planning, where they document their goals and values and preferences and thought their advanced directive, since we know that those are very important, but most people don't do them. So yeah. Now there's AI like chatbots that can talk to a patient, guide them through these conversations, and then create an advanced directive for them. Oftentimes very brilliant, very articulate. Of course, my concern, I have a lot of concerns about it, but just to mention briefly as a chaplain, not even just as an ethics perspective, but as a chaplain, one concern I have is we know that AI causes de-skilling, right? When people rely on AI, they lose some of their own skills. And I just think it's so sad if we lose the skill to have meaningful conversations about people's, what matters for people. I mean, it's one thing to lose certain, you know, technical skills. That's okay, that's for discussion. But to lose that, the human ability to have a meaningful, impactful conversation with someone about what matters in life, that's sad to offload that to AI, even though it could help the people in the long run, because the more people will have advanced directives. And also, I do feel that, you know, people open up in different ways to different people.
Yeah.
If a pharmacist walks into the patient's room and says, "How are you feeling today?" Person's going to say like, "Oh, you know, I'm feeling drowsy from a medication or whatever it is." That's because they're talking to a pharmacist. The dietitian walks in the room. "How are you feeling today?" "Oh, you know, I'm feeling like I'm too much salt or whatever. I don't know. They're thinking about something about food." If a chaplain walks in the room and says, "You know, tell me what's going on today," it opens up a different aspect of the person's, you know, soul, so to speak. And I'm afraid that if people only have these conversations with a bot, it might not bring out the same reflection and the same kind of emotions that it could bring out with a human being who maybe tears up a little bit when they're talking, shows compassion, seems like they really care. It's a different dynamic. And I'm afraid of all of our human interactions becoming, you know, so synthetic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is a fear I'm sure we all share. And it's really interesting. We had a conversation with a number of Catholic scholars earlier this year on the podcast, and they were sharing that they have observations that certain Catholics, especially young Catholics, might feel more comfortable in confession with an AI priest than they might feel in confession with a human priest, which of course brings all sorts of questions and concerns about that as well. And it's a difficult balancing act because, of course, Catholics believe, and even non-Catholics know, that sharing what's burdening you is a really wonderful and valuable thing for one to do. And it's like, if you're going to share with nothing, then maybe share with AI is better, but we can all agree sharing with human is better than AI, and creates these very difficult and complicated questions for us to think about. Now, Tracy, bringing you back into this, what are a few things that you're noticing where AI has been introduced into the medical space, and what are some of the big questions you're thinking about?
Well, just to build on the topic that you were just looking at, you and Jason, right now, around advanced directives, one of my fears as an ethicist and as a spiritual care provider is that we're going to lose the ability to catch the nuances that we really need to catch, because there are certain prevailing societal messages around what we should want and what we shouldn't want in terms of a good quality life. And some of those messages aren't always helpful or accurate. For example, think about the case of somebody with dementia. If you are really afraid of getting dementia because the messaging in society is that makes you a less valuable human being. You don't have access to the same rational cognitive thinking skills that you do now, and that is still assumed to be at the heart of what it means to be a valuable functioning member of society. But it's more complicated than that. When people do get dementia, some people are very happy still and find joy in small pleasures. It might be that they enjoy the green Jell-O they get every other day and really want more of that and can really celebrate that when it comes and be more present and centered in life. Whereas for other people, it might be that they get very aggressive and angry and are confused and distressed all the time. So we don't know what it is that we're going to be like if we do get dementia. But a prevailing societal message is that we should want to die if we get dementia badly enough that we can't function independently. Because independence, too, in addition to rational thought, is hypervalued in our North American Western society. So if we're not independent and we need the help of other people, which, of course, is a profoundly spiritual need, and we all need other people, but we just choose not to believe that sometimes because we don't want to be dependent upon other people. But it's an interdependence that is very rich and meaningful and is believed to be intended divinely in many religious traditions. So what is it that a prevailing social norm is teaching us about our value in life, depending on what medical conditions we get, and how will that be amplified by the bots that we talk to about making plans for our future and about assessing when we should die and when we shouldn't die? This is all very, very complex, and it really does go to that tendency of a lot of large language models to perpetuate systemic biases in society. And we see that too with medical research and healthcare research, right? So we have more research still done with certain groups of people. With white, able-bodied men, they still have more research done, more studies. Now that's getting addressed and is shifting a bit, but we still run the risk right now anyways of having AI impose those normative criteria on everybody instead of saying, oops, you know, we're not all the same. Yeah. And only is that, you know, a fact that we need to be cognizant of, but that it's a good thing. It's part of the joy of being human.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love how that touches on what Jason touched on in the beginning, which is each of us values things differently and things about our life differently. So there isn't one right answer, which I think is something that for people who've maybe only taken a logic or an ethics class once in college, it feels almost like an equation that if you're smart enough, you can get to the other side. And I really love how all of our conversation today is really centered around humans and humanity. Now, before we run out of time, I do want to touch about a couple more elements within this realm of kind of bioethics and kind of greater ecosystem we've touched on in the past. And first are robots and bots in general. And a longtime listener of the pod will remember that a couple of years ago, we had a guest who created a grief bot for his kids. His father passed away, and he wanted his kids to have an experience of knowing their grandfather. So he took all of his grandfather's writings, or his dad, his kid's grandfather's writings, and trained a bot on that, that his kids could now ask questions to and interact with their grandpa or with an AI version of their grandpa. And 10 years, 15 years later, when you ask him, what was that experience like? There seemed to be a lot of questions more than answers. And one of the examples that I loved is he talked about how he has two much older brothers. And if you ask his older brother to describe their dad, if you ask him to describe their dad, they describe a different person because it was a different decade where they were being raised by their dad. So, of course, one of the questions about these grief bots is, who's actually being mirrored here? And we all change throughout our lives. So there's all these examples. The other example we've talked about on the podcast is robots to help with loneliness. And you see this sometimes in Asia, where you have age pyramids where there's more older people than younger people. As I like to say, even if every grandchild was a doting grandchild, there's probably not enough grandchildren to visit all the grandparents. So sometimes people create AI pets, AI companions, robot companions. And there's the difficult question of, does that actually help the person in the long term to actually take them away from society? So I know I've put a lot out there, but how do you think about robots and bots, Tracy? And what are some of the kind of the key ethical questions around that?
I love that topic. It's so important and so rich and so complicated. So grief bots, the core ethical issue there, I think, is deception. No matter what, the bot is not the person.
Yeah.
Yet the bot is programmed and designed to be like the person and to be experienced as the person. But the trouble is, of course, you can dump in all of the digital footprint you can find, and the person who is recreated as this grief bot is not going to necessarily respond to a new situation the same way that you would have if you were alive. We can't know that for sure. Now, on the other hand, in spite of this deception, there's some indication that grief bots can help with grief, that there is the possibility of being able to say goodbye, to process one's grief in a way that could be very constructive and helpful. It would be like the gestalt empty chair,
yeah.
But more, right? More. So that if you didn't get a chance to say goodbye, in the case of a sudden death in particular, then you could indeed have that conversation, even though it's not an actual conversation with the actual person, and work through some of that. I think the key is working with a trained spiritual care provider there and processing that and then letting it go. Because if you don't let it go, and some of these companies like Versona, their slogan is never have to say goodbye, right? That this person could live on forever as a grief bot, and you'd never have to really acknowledge that they died. You'd never have to acknowledge that humans are mortal. You'd never have to actually go through deep grief. Another big problem is with complicated grief, and particularly with very young children who don't understand mortality. This can be extremely confusing and is not going to be helpful at all, realizing why this person isn't physically there in their lives, but they're in this screen in front of us, and they're still there, but they're not there. But, you know, who are they? Where are they? What are they coming out? These are big, big, big questions. And grief bots are going to get to be more and more common. You can design your own grief bot for nothing if you just use text and some basic programming. And not only that, when I was talking with an LLM, Claude, about this, Claude immediately offered to help me create a grief bot for nothing. I said, no, that's not quite what I want here, but just tell me a little more about the pricing, et cetera. So between 20,000 and 40,000 US, you could get the whole meal deal with a grief bot. The avatar, the thing you see on television shows now, I mean, fiction and shows, TV, streaming platforms, we're seeing more and more about grief bots. And so that sort of leads into your second question about bots and loneliness, because of course, grief bots can seem to fill a loneliness hole, that deep, deep ache of missing someone. The other bots can fill the more general hole of living in a fragmented, highly individualistic society, which we're seeing loneliness is becoming declared an epidemic in many, many countries. And we're needing to figure out how to deal with this, because it's a condition, loneliness, that is not only a spiritual condition, but is connected to physical health conditions.
Absolutely.
Because we're integrated wholes, right? We can't just take out this one piece and not have it affect the rest. So what do we do here? Because AI is offering us something that does seem to help sometimes alleviate loneliness. Because like you said, we don't all have the grandchild to come and visit us, right? We don't all have the family member necessarily to come visit us. We could be sitting there alone, not sure how to reach out relationally. I think with the pandemic, especially, our capacity to know how to initiate relationships is suffering more and more. So we need help with that. And the risk is that as a society, we become increasingly separated. Will the bots help with that, or will they exacerbate that? I think that sometimes they will help with it and sometimes they will exacerbate it. So the pet bots, the seals that we had in the wake of the tsunami in Japan, I think it was 2011, were shown to really have a wonderful therapeutic impact on supporting people and giving them comfort. Who would have thought, right? But they definitely did seem to work. And we have more sophisticated AI pets now, and they do seem to provide comfort and company to people. We have Alexa and Hey Google, right? They can tell us a joke in the morning. This is not a bad thing. Where it becomes complicated, I think, is when we rely too heavily on the bot for all of our relational needs, and we walk away from humans.
Yeah, and forget that when I think about this all the time, that there's something magical about spending time with another human, which is that they're choosing to spend that time with you. They're choosing to give you their time, their attention, their energy. And I would say, even if we had two AIs on this call today and they were just as interesting, they would not be choosing to do, they would not be giving me a part of their humanity. And there is something really special about that, which is why I think this is such a difficult balancing act. Now, Jason, we'll give you the last question. We have a lot of people who listen to this podcast who are creating with AI. These might be religious leaders creating for their communities. These might be entrepreneurs creating businesses, academics, et cetera. So within the medical field specifically, within the hospital setting, what's some advice that you would share with people bringing AI into the world, into the hospital setting? What should they have in mind to do so in a way that's ethical and practical?
I would encourage people to have a set of goals. I mean, sometimes it's like, what can I do? Well, it's so cool. Let me try to accomplish. And, you know, we often say in many traditions, but just because you can do something does not mean that you should do it. And we have to think long and hard about the ramifications of our actions. And I would encourage people to, first of all, talk to someone else. Sometimes people get kind of, you know, lone rangery about this. Look what I can accomplish. Look what I can do. And they get excited because they want to get accolades. And it's, you know, with AI, there's so much more that you can do kind of alone. And I would, you know, sometimes when I hear about really bad things that go poorly, I'm like, did they ever run that by someone? Because how would that conversation would have, you know, sometimes just run it by someone and think, am I doing this because I want to help people? Is this for the ultimate greater good? Is this going to help people? Am I thinking about the potential pitfalls and the consequences of my actions? Am I thinking about concerns related to justice and equity, being inclusive and recognizing the impacts that could have on people that I might not be thinking about, but who I should be thinking about as well?
Yeah.
You know, and ultimately, is this going to be, you know, help people? That if we're going to help people and do good, obviously we just be careful and carefully examine if we're going in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a beautiful answer. And it actually dovetails really nicely with the story we heard on our last episode of the podcast. We had Marcus with us, who is a senior editor at AI and Faith, and he shared this incredible story. So he is a chemist and a scientist. And he was working on a project a few years ago to create an AI algorithm that would identify less toxic chemicals that could replace more toxic chemicals in manufacturing processes. So if you need a certain chemical to make this chair more sturdy, more shiny, more flexible, whatever you might want to this chair, they're going to see, is there another chemical that could do the same thing with less toxicity to the public? But his brilliant wife pointed out that once he put out the algorithm, if you just flip the sign from a negative to positive, it could also identify chemicals that are more toxic and could hurt people more in the manufacturing process. And we talked a lot about red teaming, which is kind of a tech term for putting on the bad guy hat and chasing, really thinking about your own invention from that perspective, which is exactly what you shared with us as well. So I completely agree. And I thought that was a beautiful dovetail with the way we finished our last episode, talking about this great responsibility we all have as we create technology, as we create these new capabilities and put them into the world. Now, I want to say thank you, not just for joining me today, but for the work you do in the world. And as all of our listeners know, I'm so excited about the future AI can bring, but only if we have people like you to make sure it's rooted in ethics, in doing the right thing, and of course, in being people-centered first and foremost. Now, before I let you go, we do have a lightning round. Three questions, 15 seconds apiece, and Tracy, you're going to kick us off. So the first question is simple. What is one fun use case you use with AI? Something small, something you do every day that you like doing with AI.
Maybe that's not as simple.
That's a fair answer.
Asking what the weather is.
Yeah, okay. Jason?
You know, I'm very into working out. When I feel certain like pain and I need a good stretch, I ask it, what's a good stretch or exercise to deal with, you know, back pain or ankle pain or something like that? That's been helpful to me with that.
That's awesome. Perfect. I have a friend who told me yesterday that she takes a picture of an outfit and has it recommend what jewelry would go well with the outfit she's wearing, which I thought was kind of someone who doesn't have a lot of fashion sense myself. I was like, that's a pretty good one. Okay, Jason, you go first this time. What is one piece of advice or wisdom you've learned from your students?
From my students, I've learned to be curious and not feel like you know everything, but want to learn more.
Absolutely. And Tracy?
The importance of being authentic, just being present and able to give a hug.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then last one, I promise this is an easy one, Tracy. What is your favorite summer treat?
Ice cream.
Oh, that's a good one. What flavor?
Cookie dough.
Cookie dough. That's a good one. And Jason?
Well, I love the beach and I love running at the beach, especially early in the morning and in the summer. I just find that there's more time for being at the beach. So that's my summer treat.
I will say beach yoga for me. Thank you both so much for joining us and for everything you do in the world. And of course, thank you to all of you in the AI and faith community for joining us for another important conversation. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more conversations and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share it with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on social media. We are on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us.